This is CliffCentral.com.
Bill knew more about men's shoes than anyone in the retail chain, a chain of about 150 stores with just over 1,000 shoe sellers. As for me, I knew little to nothing, but it was a perfect college job. On the afternoon of my third day, Bill told me to never make the mistake that I just made again. The customer asked for a size 9, and I went to the back and saw we didn't have the size, and I told the customer he was out of luck. When the next customer came in, Bill told me to stand back and just watch. See, Bill's customer asked for a size 10 and a black lace-up cap toe, our most popular style. Bill said, okay, but first he asked the customer, did he mind measuring his foot? After measuring him, Bill agreed with the customer and said, I can see how you can wear a size 10, and then proceeds to go to the back and bring out a size 9 and ask the customer to try it on and walk around in it. Bill turned the box around so the customer didn't see the size. The customer walked around and after a few steps smiled and said, these size 10 are perfect. After ringing the customer up, Bill walked the customer to the exit and told him to enjoy his shoes, and if, after wearing them for a few days, if you wanted to exchange them for another size, feel free to come back. The customer would always say, just like this one, I know my size, so I won't need to exchange them. I watched Bill do this 100 or 200 times. The customer never came back. Bill looked at me and said, if their brain thinks they're wearing a size 10 and their foot is comfortable, then a size 9 is a size 10. Welcome back to the next episode of the Brain and Brand Show. I'm your host, Timothy Maurice, and this is the show where we explore the link between brain and brand power, how brands impact your psyche, and how your brain can be optimized to influence brands. Today, we explore how brands trick our brains. To explore this, we look to the leading voice, Mr. Eric Vance, a science writer and the author of Suggestible You, The Curious Science of Your Brain's Ability to Deceive, Transform, and Heal. Eric Vance, welcome to the Brain and Brand Show.
Hey, thanks for having me. This is great.
So you're based in between Mexico City and California. Where are you now?
Yeah, I'm actually in Mexico City right now. I like that, between, you know, between California and Mexico City. I guess that'd be on the border. I switched between the two, but I live in Mexico City, which is actually a wonderful place to be based, and a lot of opportunities to look at this very question, actually, because belief and expectation is all around us down here. So I've been here for about 7 years, and I love it.
Awesome. Before we get into how brands mess with our heads and what that means, you've researched the intelligence of dolphins. Are dolphins intelligent enough to be president of the United States?
I 2 years ago, I would have said no. So, this year, maybe, I don't know. There's certainly a lot in common. Dolphins are really interesting animals. You know, if you look at them long enough, you realize both how intelligent and kind of human-like they are, and also how animal-like they are, and really, you know, unhuman-like. And it's the person who actually introduced me to that world was actually a SETI researcher, someone who looks for extraterrestrial life. And I think that's fitting because dolphins they're not human. It's really hard to say what they are. They're really an alien life in a lot of ways. There's something so different from us. Wow. So yeah, they're crazy smart, but they're also animals. So you spend a lot of time ping-ponging back between those two things, which I guess at least the second half might apply to the president.
Yeah, exactly. Last year, I was in the science section of my favorite bookstore, and I came across your book, Suggestible You. I began reading in the bookstore, planning to scan it and put it back, to be honest, thinking it was just another helpful book about the placebo effect. I was like, you know, but I couldn't put it down. And as I read further, I knew I had to buy it, which I did, and glad I did. What struck me early in the book was your relationship with faith and science. Share with me a bit more about the moment where you realized that that you were, you know, you were moving a bit in that space.
Well, I started at a different spot than a lot of people. I was raised in a religion called Christian Science, which relies on faith as a form of healing. Christian scientists, a lot of faith healers in the world, Christian scientists are somewhat unusual in that they only rely on faith. So they don't go to doctors generally. And that's just a big decision in Christian Science if you want to go to a dentist. It was something where you really have to be committed to that. I mean, and in my teens, you know, you're not committed to anything. And so I was really sort of drifting away. But it was on a very steep mountain called, Lost Arrow Spire in Yosemite National Park. I'm very into rock climbing, and we were sort of several thousand feet up this very thin needle, you know, with ropes and clipped into a sort of overhanging rock. And a lightning storm came in, and, you know, nothing shows you the power of God like a lightning storm. I mean, it's just so overpowering. You can't describe how overpowering and frightening that is, especially when it's sort of hitting nearby peaks. And, you know, I reached out to God at that moment, and it was just like, you know, help me. And what was interesting to me, you know, and you make this, all this stuff is so personal, but for me, I didn't hear anything back. And maybe my expectations were too high, you know, that I expected to hear something. But I just had this moment, you know, and I actually survived. So someone might argue, you know, maybe God saved me. But I just had this moment where I said, you know, I didn't hear anything. And that might mean something. And for me, it was a very important moment. I mean, everyone, it's, you know, it's also personal in terms of how you interpret your life in terms of faith. And for me, that was sort of my moment where I said, I'm going to look elsewhere for explanations and how the world works. And so I started experimenting with all kinds of drugs, you know, Tylenol, you know, aspirin,
yeah, yeah.
Bayer.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
yeah. And, you know, and I was kind of out, but I was always curious about what I had seen and what I had experienced when I was a kid. And so that's really where a lot of this book comes from, is sort of a desire for me to understand, because, you know, I healed myself all the time when I was a kid, and I wasn't crazy, and my family wasn't crazy. Something was happening, and that's what really drives this book, is what was that thing? Not, you know, take out all the woo-woo and just figure out what was going on. And it turns out there's a lot of interesting explanations for what I experienced.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, that's actually the crux of why I wanted to have this conversation, is that when you're on top of this mountain, you had an expectation. And, you know, I want to explore the power of expectation. And, you know, for example, how, as in the case of the shoe store, when I opened up this podcast today, you know, how does expectation actually physically influence the brain?
Yeah, great question. This, you know, everyone who writes a book thinks their book is like everything, right? Like the whole world. This literally is everything. Like, yeah. Expectation, if you had to boil your brain down to a single function, and this isn't me saying this, this is, you know, experts in artificial intelligence, and I mean, this has been known for about 50 years. It has one job, and that is prediction. It is a prediction machine.
Yes.
And that's essentially what your brain does. And it makes small ones, you know, like all throughout your life, I have a baby, and he's trying to figure out how to make these predictions, you know, like what happens when I drop something. And we have these predictions that we've built up over our life. Little ones like gravity, you know, if I drop something, it'll fall. Big ones like, you know, are the Cubs going to win next year, or will the hunting be good in the plains? But this is like what our brain does, is it just looks for shortcuts, you know, uses predictions to look for shortcuts and figure out how the world works. Take the past, apply it to the present to predict the future. That's what our brain does. And so when you start messing with those predictions, you alter fundamental properties in the brain. Like this is not political leaning, you know, like political leanings, you know, how that works in the brain. It's like people study that. That's really interesting. But like expectation, predictions, that's deep. That is fundamental to what our brains do. I mean, if you look at a planaria, a little flatworm, like, it's kind of what they're doing too, you know, like this is basic. And so what a placebo effect does, and a lot of things I write about, is you are starting to change those fundamental expectations by tricking yourself. So when you take a pill and you think it's a painkiller, and it's not, you're playing with an expectation, with a machinery that is very basic in the brain, and so your brain kicks in with some very powerful effects. One of those is to release actual opioids onto itself so that it feels what it expects, because your brain would rather change reality then change an expectation.
Yeah, wow.
If it can. Yeah. If it can, and that's, I think, what your friend, the shoe store, was seeing is, like, if it can fudge enough so that expectation meets reality, it will, rather than changing the expectation. Because once those things are set, you know, the brain doesn't want to reevaluate the world. It wants to make the world fit its expectations. Now, yeah, you can take that and apply it to all kinds of things. And that's sort of what I do, and that's how it applies to marketing as well.
Got it. You know, it's interesting. When I first came to South Africa, one of the things that shocked me, you know, was, you know, after a while I was single here. And, you know, in the Cape Town community, which you've lived in Cape Town, you've spent some time there, you know, there's this community of colored people. And colored people are people who have this sort of history where hair was really, really important. Where in the same family, if your hair was straighter, you would go to a white school. If your hair was really curly and thick, you'd go to a black school. So hair was just like this tool to help you navigate society. And so when my hair is really short, I look more white. When it's long, I look black. I would often meet young women in the club, and they'd really like me. And then I'd let my hair grow out, and then it's like, oh, no. You're going to make my kids dark and black, and they're going to ruin their lives. And it was extraordinary to see how, when the expectation of what my hair may do to their child would completely turn them off, their whole body would start shaking. So I'm interested in how, when they physically saw my hair and how it could create an expectation for their progeny, how, what actually happened in their head? Like, what was it that caused their nervous system to be shut off or turned away, or what happened?
Wow, that's really, you know, now you're playing with two really deep fundamental processes in the human brain, expectation and reproduction. yeah. So, I mean, you know, this is a really crazy thing, and I haven't, like, this would be a really great thing for me to dig into. I know that my wife used to work in the Dominican Republic, and a lot of immigrants who leave the Dominican Republic think of themselves as white, and when they come to the United States, they learn that they're black, and in the DR, they're white, you know, and it's like, that changes, you know, how you see yourself, you know. It changes so many expectations, like those big expectations that are like, you know, what your future is and how you act. So we have a limited – what we know is that expectations, when they change, your brain can very quickly tap into chemicals that it has on hand, like dopamine, like serotonin, cannabinoids, which you might recognize from marijuana. Yes. Like, we've got those in our head already, and your brain can drop them out when it wants them in order to make things sort of make sense. Yeah. The problem is we don't have a complete list. I mean, we don't know everything that your brain can tinker with. So, you know, and we really don't know what attracts a woman to a man. I mean, we definitely know that there are some very subtle pheromones that may or may not be, we may or may not be able to sense, you know, and whether or not your brain, you know, like you smell a pheromone and you feel attracted to someone. We may not be able to smell these pheromones, but, you know, it's still, we're still trying to figure that out. But, you know, whether or not your brain would then change the way it perceives that, you know, all of those signals it's getting from that person when it realizes this person is darker than they thought. I mean, it's just too subtle. Like, there's so many chemicals I could think of, you know,
But we know that there is some sort of chemical change that causes, you know, her body, who she is, to shift when an expectation of what she thought was happening. When that expectation changed, something changed.
I would put money on that. I mean, unfortunately, I had a placebo researcher tell me, you know, we have really lousy placebos in the laboratory. You know, I mean, you can only do so much. You know, you can put someone in pain and you can see if you can make that pain go away. To look at something like attractiveness, that would be tough. At least to figure out the chemical underpinnings, that would be tough.
Sure.
But there are a lot of studies looking at the subtlety of facial recognition. And, I mean, when it comes to, like, looking at someone's face and evaluating a person's face, evaluating if they're in pain or if they're attractive, our brains are really good at it. I mean, it's most of, you know, what their sort of the higher functions are made to do. So yeah, when you bring in something like an expectation, that a person is a certain, you know, looks a certain way, has, or even something simpler like money. You know, if someone was to find out that someone was not as rich as they thought they were, or yes, that there was, you know, or that they weren't as beautiful in some way, you know, in some other setting, how would that affect the chemical process in their brain? No question it would. I don't think we're ready yet to say exactly which ones, but there's no question that there would be chemical changes going on. And the question is, could you use that to your advantage? Could you make yourself continue to be attractive just by, you know, by these subtle cues?
Yeah, well, exactly. And one way we can do that, obviously, is with brands. Brands allow us social triggers and opportunity, which I want to get to, you know, sort of like the heart and the meat of, you know, why I wanted, really wanted you on the show is, you know, how can brands do that? I mean, would you argue that the brands that are the most successful are the ones that manage the consumer's expectations, the one that gets the brain moving towards what they want them. So, for example, you know, you find in basketball in America, it's a massive, you know, thing that when a young person is wearing Nike over Adidas, they feel better. And, you know, there have been studies to show that they perform better. You know, people, you know, people wearing Michael Jordan shoes, sort of, it's like in clothed cognition, their brain starts to feel the properties of Michael Jordan, and they may not fly, but they feel like they're closer to him than they were before they put the shoes on.
Yeah. And this is an area that, that marketing placebos, as they're often called, that is it's getting some attention, and unfortunately not as, you know, a lot of it happens behind closed doors, and so, you know, we have limited picture of how much is actually out there, but I mean it's so widespread. I mean, it's not just Michael Jordan's. It's if you give someone an MIT pen, you know, in small studies we've found that people perform better on that, on a test using an MIT pen. It's like that constant, you know, suggestion that you are smart enough to be at MIT, you know, and like that's branding. Like, MIT, there's nothing special about those letters,
but it's crazy. Branding. I have to say this, Eric, you know, I did a diploma in neuroscience at MIT, and whenever I wear my MIT shirt in South Africa, it means nothing. I walk through people, but when I'm in the States, like when I was home a couple months ago or a few weeks ago, you know, like elderly people would stop me almost in like reverence. It was weird. Anyway, I just wanted to throw that in there.
There'd be a whole other study for, like, you know, going to clubs and picking up on women with an MIT shirt.
Yeah,
like
exactly.
I could go either way.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, like, and one of the most interesting thing, you know, elements of sort of creating expectation, I think, is like the classic expectation generator, which is price tag, right? Mm. Like, so that's the great thing about marketing is you have this like one tool, which is the price tag, that can have a huge effect on people's expectations, right?
Yes.
I mean, if something's expensive, it really should be better. And we all know, you know, we all know sort of on the surface that this isn't true. Like, just because something's expensive doesn't mean it's better. But I mean, you were just saying you bought my book. My book's a lot more expensive in South Africa than it is in the States. Like, that doesn't make it any better. But there are a lot of experiments that look at how that affects people's experience. Now, I'm looking forward to seeing these things really get explored more. But there's a fair amount of evidence, I think, that, you know, if you buy an expensive bottle of wine that's identical to a cheaper bottle of wine, the expensive one tastes better. I think that the science will, there's evidence to that, and I think the science will eventually show that, you know, your brain makes that bottle taste better. I don't think you can make grape juice like taste, you know, like some really expensive bottle of wine, but if there's a little wiggle room, your brain will add the extra pleasure, the extra this dopamine is a reward drug that makes you feel more happy about the thing you've just done, but also all the subtle chemicals involved in the taste experience. There's no question that you are tasting something better, in my mind. And all it is the price. Now that price signifies a lot though, right? Like it's telling you, so many little subtle signals, and that's something that is easy to sort of play with in this realm. And the other one is, of course, brands that have worked really, really hard to to create a certain image. Coca-Cola being the most obvious. Coca-Cola always loses to Pepsi in blind taste tests, but it always wins when it's not blind.
Yeah.
You know, not always, but you know, it's so common that we, you know, there's really no denying that when you enjoy Coke, you're part of what you're enjoying is the can.
Yes. Absolutely.
And I think that's real. I mean, people say, oh, you know, you're lying to yourself. No, I think your brain might actually be making that thing taste better. And I think there's a lot of evidence building on that your brain will actually make things taste better because it doesn't want to be wrong. And so when it has an expectation, it'll just fill in the gaps.
Yeah. I mean, and that leads to the next question around, you know, the reverse. You know, conversely, when, you know, you feel like you're wearing something cheaper, you feel like you're driving a cheaper car, you don't know that the brand, your experience. So the nocebo effect. Break down for us and share with us a bit about the sibling of placebo, the nocebo.
ugly stepson or ugly stepbrother, whatever. Yeah. So nocebos in the lab, again, you know, you're taking these things in the lab, which are being studied, very carefully, you know, and with pain and with stomach problems, and you're trying to like apply these things, these much more complicated experiences. So in the lab, a nocebo experience is when, you expect more pain and someone doesn't, you know, it gives you the exact same pain you got before, but you feel more pain. You rate it stronger. And this applies to pretty much any time you have negative expectations. And I in the book, I sort of expand this looking at sort of superstition. And eventually I even get myself cursed as a way to understand like how your expectation would change your experience in a negative way. And I think we've all heard of like mass hysteria and these different things where people expect something bad to happen and with no trigger, you know, their experience gets a lot worse. And so the question would be, well, how does nocebo affect someone's marketing experience? I'm reminded of who's the guy who had those inexpensive basketball shoes? He was a professional basketball player who created a line of cheap basketball shoes that were really actually pretty good. And he used them in the NBA, but they're meant to be sort of affordable. They're like $50 or something like that. And I forget the guy's name, but he had a lot of trouble selling them because you know, they weren't bad shoes. They certainly, the difference between those and Air Jordans, you know, probably wasn't even registered by the average consumer, but that brand and that sense that you're buying something cheaper, you know, that you only paid $50 for these shoes, it affects performance and it certainly affects, you know, happiness. You know, I mean, you look at some of these chemicals that are involved in placebos, and a lot of them are tied to well-being, tied to rewards, that, you know, how we see the world. Serotonin's a big one. And you start messing with those things, you know, expectations. We think of these things as like, well, you just have to tell yourself, you know, that it's not happening. It's not that easy. These things are really deep, and you can't just make yourself happy with something that has been conditioned over your whole life to expect something that's cheaper to be worse. And then suddenly it's like, oh, I bought this cheap thing and now I should be happy with it the same way I would be at double the price. And that's just not the way your brain works. I mean, you know, you can't overcome that entire lifetime of experience by snapping your fingers, even if it's the same shoe. You can't just do that. And these are powerful things. And these are things that bring down multi-billion-dollar drugs. Because when the placebo or the nocebo effect are too high with a drug, you can't tell if they work. And, you know, billions of dollars go to waste. And, you know, these aren't small effects. These are big things.
Absolutely. You argue in your book that we're more wired for fear than for relief. Is this because fear helps us to ensure survival more? Why is that the case?
Yeah, so this is the thing about nocebo effects. We don't know a lot about them. They're hard. I mean, if you take Parkinson's disease, you know, I can give someone a pill and tell them it'll make their Parkinson's better. And if it's a placebo, I can do that. And chances are their Parkinson's will get better because Parkinson's is very placebo prone. I can't give someone a pill and tell them it'll make their Parkinson's worse. Like, that's just not right. You can't do that. Sure. So there's a lot of studies you can't do with nocebos because they're just really unethical. But what we know a few things about them, and one of the things we know is that they seem to be easier to create, and they persist longer than placebos, which is another way of saying that fear is sort of more powerful than hope. And, you know, I know there's a scientist out there right now who's rolling their eyes, but that's what we're talking about, like at a very basic level. So the question would be, why would that be? Well, you know, off the cuff, talking to experts about why this might be, you know, a lot of people say, well, if, you know, you line up a bunch of people, cavemen, and they're eating mushrooms, and the one who's very, very cautious and afraid, he might go hungry because he won't eat those mushrooms. And everyone else eats well, but then on that, you know, fourth or fifth or sixth day, you know, someone gets one of these, you know, people with a lot of hope gets the wrong mushroom and dies. And while that other one, the fearful one, he might be hungry, but he'll live. You know, fear keeps you alive.
Got it.
In a lot of ways. And that would explain why fear, I mean, just look at the news, you know, like fear-based headlines do way better than hope-based headlines. And there's probably a very strong reason for that. And it also applies to nocebo effects. So when, you know, when they've done experiments where they sort of mix, they give you an expectation, then they take it away and they give it back, which is, they get really complicated, but they're very interesting. What you see is these nocebo effects, they hang around in your brain. These negative expectations hang around and they persist. And that makes sense. I mean, we're fearful creatures. The problem is it's hard to understand these things more effectively without doing really twisted and terrible experiments. I think when you look at marketing as well, you probably see businesses that suffer from that. Once you have a negative expectation of a brand, it would make sense that would be very hard to change.
Got it. You know, and I think that's important for, you know, brand leaders to be very conscious of the fact that if your consumer starts to really fear you on some level, or you really sort of struggle with, you know, expectations, that's going to impact their relationship. You know, I want to talk about the power of storytelling. I mean, when, you know, a brand is ultimately, you know, evolves into some sort of story, what are some storytelling sort of techniques in terms of how that sort of impacts, you know, a potential brand?
So that's a great question. Storytelling, just to catch your listeners up, storytelling is a big part of placebo creation. It's a big part of what we do in medicine. You know, when someone explains to you what's going on in your body, there's a lot of storytelling. It's also a big part of traditional medicine, which relies heavily on placebo, but there's very strong storytelling. I just spent a couple weeks traveling around through the mountains of Mexico with the PBS NewsHour on a show all about this, sort of how traditional healers use storytelling. It depends if we're talking about a good story or a bad story. I mean, on the bad side, I still can remember, and I don't even remember the details, but I know that Tylenol had a horrible experience in the 80s, I think it was, with misbranding or something like that. Like, there's this horrible thing that happened with Tylenol, and there's this horrible thing that happened also with Jack in the Box. And I will always remember that Jack in the Box had some terrible salmonella outbreak or something like that. And I'll remember that forever, because these things, there's this storytelling that happens in your mind about this brand, and then I get attached to that. Whereas I may not remember all the good things that happened with some of these products. But when the one where it really comes down for me is, my first work was with sustainable fishing, looking at restaurants that claim to be, that have sustainable fish. The same could be true for, you know, cruelty-free, shoes, or, you know, the blood-free diamonds and things like this. You know, and there's a lot of these claims made, and they really do affect the person's experience positively. Now, in my research, what I found with the fishing, and what's certainly true with the diamonds and a lot of other things, is a lot of these claims are bunk. You know, a lot of people, there's no one really enforcing these things in the United States. People will say something sustainable. You know, you get this sustainable salmon, and you know, fresh sustainable salmon in the middle of the winter from Alaska, and you're like, wait a minute, you know, what boat is out there right now in the winter. Like, it's January. Sure. No one's sending salmon down from Alaska. Exactly. Trust me. And there's even a story in the New York Times where this guy was looking at this, you know, this box that said farmed Atlantic salmon, and the guy said, you know, on the advertisement, they said, you know, fresh Alaska salmon. And someone's like, look, you know, it says right there farmed Atlantic salmon. And the guy's like, are you going to trust me or are you going to trust the box?
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, I'm going to trust the box, man. You're lying to me. But that experience that you're getting, you're doing something good. This is storytelling. Is, you know, there's this, you know, indigenous tribe of people, and they made this thing by hand, and, you know, and everyone got paid enough money to support their family, and they're bringing this community up, and now you're wearing it on your feet. You know, does that, you know, that shoe or that diamond, you know, does that affect the way you see that experience? No question it does. No question you look at your shoe, and maybe it's even more comfortable because of the storytelling that went into it. Now, I'm not saying any of this stuff is bad or good. I'm just saying this is how we are.
Yeah, I get it. Yeah. It's like coffee. Yeah. You go to a Starbucks or whatever. I mean, they're telling you that the farmers of certain coffee, we took care of them, and then people will drink the coffee with a level of pride, a heightened sense of contribution, and they feel more relevant. And, you know, all these storytelling. That's why I wanted you to break down that placebo, the relationship between that, how what happens with the story, what happens in the brain with the placebo effect. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's interesting. You know, Samsung, on the other hand, is employing almost the nocebo effect, you know, sort of teasing Apple users, you know, making them seem like a little bit backward, et cetera. You know, do you think that's a sustainable strategy?
I, you know, again, I'm not a businessman, but yeah, from the brain's perspective, if you can, you know, you have to be careful. You know, there's always a second politics, right? Like, no one wants to be the one caught, you know, caught throwing dirt. But yeah, if you can create, from what I've, you know, read and the work I've done, if you can create a negative expectation for your competitor, I would bet that, and I would bet that someone's done this research and has not published it because it's behind, you know, locked in some vault, that you, it would be more effective than necessarily creating a positive expectation for your own brand. Wow. Yeah, there's no question. And, you know, and when you look at, you look at a lot of these sustainable brands and things like that. I guarantee, you know, I was actually contacted by NOAA, the National Administration, sorry, after my story came out, and they have no way to police whether or not something's sustainable or not. They can barely police whether or not it's the fish that's being claimed that it is. Sure. You know, like you're eating red snapper and it's some other totally different fish. But, you know, no one's keeping track of that. So I guarantee, you know, I mean, I think 70% of the red snapper people eat is not red snapper. And so, you know, but that experience still happens, you know, and so, you know, and if you could create a negative, you know, a negative expectation for the other, another brand, these would be powerful, powerful tools for competing. I don't know if it'd be ethical. I don't know if I'd recommend someone do that.
Well, politicians use this strategy all the time, right? Politicians use this all the time. Politicians.
Oh, yeah. You know who else does this? Another area that's just being started to look at, or people are just starting to look at, is athletics. And there's a guy named Chris Beattie in England who's doing, like, pretty much the only work on this. And he was talking to this professional, famous runner who he wouldn't tell me his name, but, you know, he's really well established. Everyone looks at him, you know, these track meets, or these, you know, these running meets, and he'll walk around before the race, and he'll look at someone's shoe. People respect him, obviously. So he'll look at someone's shoe and say, "Hey, what shoes are you using? Oh, you're using those shoes. Oh, that's an interesting choice. I would not have used those shoes. No, that'll be great. That'll be a great shoe to use. No, you'll be fine. Wow, I'm excited to see you run. You know, and it's like the guy's looking at his shoe, going like, what? Like, what did I? I mean, wow. Like, shoes are a big deal for these guys. And, you know, and what the theory is that, that anxiety and expectation might take up as much room in performance as performance enhancing drugs. Remember that there are illegal performance enhancing drugs that have not outperformed placebos. Mm. So that they're illegal, you can't use them, but no one's shown that they work.
Sure.
And so, you know, it works the opposite ways. And of course, you know, this is a long held practice in like baseball. you know, if you want to psych someone out, there are, you know, thousands of ways to get inside someone's head. I think it's more interesting in things like cycling and running where, you know, it's just physical performance. Like, it's just how far you can push your body. And what you find is that you do see a boost, like, in just how long someone can ride a bike just based on their expectations. If you lie to them and tell them you're giving them steroids, this is an experiment that's been done a number of times, and give them a placebo, you will see performance that they could not otherwise do. And that, I think, you know, I mean, it's the same game. It's where you're creating real change in people.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, Eric, I have to tell you, you have a great ending to your book, and I really love the, you know, as a writer myself, I appreciate when I read, I usually read with two hats on. And, you know, after I really enjoyed the book and got to the end, I put my other hat on and tried to learn from the structure and how your publisher and how you guys came together and closed the book. And I love the idea that you closed the book about how all of us are gullible. Just unpack that a bit.
That's that's good. I'm really glad you got to the end. I'm really glad you liked it. I mean, gullible is one of those words we actually talked about a lot because it is a really negative word. And I wanted to bring it in early. I liked the word a lot. And it you know, it was something that really I didn't think, you know, it wasn't appropriate to bring into the end until you can really understand that these are fundamental properties. Suddenly gullible doesn't sound so bad. Like, this is, we have so many value judgments on someone's suggestibility, you know? Like, if they're somehow weak, if they're suggestible. And gullible is like that word that ties that all up. And really, it's ridiculous. And this is who we are. Anyone who thinks, you know, I always love when people come up to me with, you know, with these like some sort of, oh, acai berries or some sort of new health thing, like, oh, look, I'm not gullible or anything like this, but this stuff really works. You know, this stuff really works. And it's like, okay, first of all, you are gullible. And so am I. And so is she. And, like, we're all gullible creatures. Don't start that way because already you're lying to yourself.
Yeah, you can see that with MTV's Punk'd. Everyone thinks you will never punk me.
Right. Exactly. And it's like, you gotta step into this game knowing, you know, that you are not the only one who can resist this stuff. Like, it's not like the whole world is susceptible and you're somehow not. Like, that's just, you know, and I think this also applies to politics, where you have these people who think, like, I'm a really, you know, thoughtful reader, and I read these things and I'm very careful, and I believe the things I believe in. I can't be led astray. I can't be fooled by some hack job. Well, of course you can. Good storytelling, you know, carefully chosen facts, they work on all of us. And so I think too many people won't admit that they're gullible. And once you do, you start seeing these things, and maybe you can help avoid them. But also, sometimes you want to go for a ride. You know, like, if I can get rid of chronic pain in my knee, I will take that gullible, like, pill. I'll do it. You know, sometimes you want to ride those brain chemicals and just see where they take you. And some of these things, many placebos are temporary, but a lot of them may be long-term or even permanent. You know, and this is a big question right now that people are looking at. And I think, you know, first step is to say, look, we're gullible. There's just no way. I'm not perfect, and I am certainly not the only person in the world who has a perfect view of it. Like, that's not me.
You know what, Eric? I was in Zara recently. I mean, you know, one of the things that I find phenomenal about this sort of fast, cheap fashion is that I think they play on our gullibility. You know, I looked, mm-hmm. I noticed something that I found very intriguing is that I think they just experiment and just, they have extra fabric and they believe that people will just wear anything. Like, I found there was a suit, a shirt, a pant, and some other, like, belt all made out of the same fabric. And because of my sort of studies in my, you know, undergrad around fashion, retail, etc., I realized that what they did was they said, they looked around and said, we've just got a whole lot of extra fabric. What can we do with this? And our consumers will buy it. So consumers can be very gullible, and brands can almost exploit that. And I think there's obviously these moral concerns and judgment. But at the end of the day, you kind of have to know what areas are your consumers gullible in? Because I can imagine in Mexico City versus LA versus Lagos in Nigeria, that gullibility will change across different markets, right?
You bet. You bet. I mean, these things are so culturally connected. You know, these things are, you know, I mean, for instance, in some countries, McDonald's is considered a very upscale restaurant. Like, you are attaching yourself to this, you know, this Western, you know, ideal. And it's like this, you know, I am someone who goes to McDonald's just like, you know, Americans. And I don't know if this is still true, but this was, you know, about 10 or 15 years old, that, you know, that people would have these experiences. And of course, we go to McDonald's, have a whole different experience. And it's also more profound than that. I, after my book came out, I was actually invited to go and speak to, I guess we'll say a shoe company that will remain nameless, because, I guess it was just so fascinating. I had this conversation, and they, and I was speaking to the segment of the company that does the really sort of cutting edge work, like looking ahead 10 years, like what are shoes going to look like in 10 years, and trying to create these sort of, you know, really the creative side of these shoemakers. And I was talking to this guy, and he said, you know, we can't really design a better shoe. Like, there's, you know, I was curious why they had me come in. Like, why do you have some random, you know, psychology, you know, science writer come in? He said, well, you know, we really can't design a better shoe. Like, we have engineered the shoe as best as we can, and we can add a couple of things, but like, it's really nothing much we can do. What we can change is people's expectation of the shoe. And some of that is very physical. Like, they'll create sensory, tactile experiences, like on your heel, like a high top shoe doesn't really do much to secure your ankle, but it does remind you that your ankle is there. You know, they sort of, you know, and his question and their question is, can we actually increase performance by just making the shoe feel like it should perform more or better just by the tactile experience? And, you know, I think this goes for a lot of different clothing, different things. I mean, like, you can't really make, we know how to make very warm clothing. We know how to make very, you know, effective clothing, and it's not as expensive as it used to be. So now there's like all of these other judgments that really, you know, creating expectations, playing in the realm of expectation is really where it's at for a lot of this stuff, for shoes. And then of course for clothing, you add a whole other layer because there isn't as much performance. You know, you're not trying to make people run faster or feel like they're running faster. You just want to make them feel good about themselves. So you really get into these things, very quickly. And I don't even think this is new. I think people have really been working this. And if you look carefully, you can see it a lot. I think people are thinking very consciously about it. Certainly we've been doing it for a long time, but I think now we're thinking very consciously about it.
Give a brand director who's listening a final tip around storytelling. Is there any sort of strategic sort of thought you'd like to leave us with in terms of, you know, really sort of leveraging the power of the placebo effect? Are there certain things that need to be in a story? Are there certain sort of concepts or framing of a story that are more effective? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, there are a few of them, and I could, you know, I could definitely pick apart a couple, but I think the most in the research, the most exciting, and this is not going to be new to anyone, is the best way to pump up a placebo effect is to, is through peer pressure. You know, you can actually, there's actually drugs you can give someone that simulates peer pressure, the experience of having people around you. And, you know, as you take this drug and, like vasopressin, and you feel more placebo effect. So that, you know, and this actually goes for addiction too. You know, I think this is also in the placebo world, getting people around you, getting that confirmation from other people is hugely powerful to creating expectations. And this, these great experiments where they have fake people, you know, adding their two cents, and it really changes people's experience in a real way. So that's a big one. The others are, you know, they're just go to a proper, quack, you know, a proper snake oil salesman, someone who's really, really fooling their customers, and just see how they work, which I spent a lot of time doing for my book, and just see how they operate. And these women and men really know how to use all of these levers better than I could ever describe, you know, in any culture, pick your culture. But these folks really know. There's people out there who passed down these traditions of of tapping into expectation for a long time.
Wow, absolutely. I really appreciate you taking the time. I encourage everyone to, you know, actually follow you on social media. You've got a great sort of social media personality as well. Just to sort of remind everyone where they can find you and find your work.
Oh, yeah. So ericvance.com is where, you know, sort of a catalog of everything I do. That's probably the best way. I've written for National Geographic, Scientific American, and a number of other national outlets. Yeah, the Times. But yeah, it's, you know, or suggestibleyou.com, you know, or follow me at Eric Vance on Twitter. It's just at Eric Vance. Yeah, so,
Eric with a K.
And I love hearing from people, like hearing people's stories. You know, whether it be marketing or health or any of these things, you know, I've heard some amazing stories since this book came out, and it blows me away how ubiquitous this stuff is.
Absolutely. I mean, I'll be reaching out to you. I mean, there's some things I think we could collaborate on here in South Africa.
Maybe I'd love it. I think it'd be great.
Yeah, absolutely. Eric Vance, thanks for joining us on the Brain and Brand Show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Continue sharing the show with those who you care about around the world, and we'll be back next week with the next episode.
This is CliffCentral.com.